Bill's heard, Representative Witt is here right now, so we're going to start with 3362. HDR 74, Representative Butler is waiting, so he will be here next. And those of you who are here for 29, 26, we'll probably do that right after that. We're not going to move that bill today. We're just going to hold the hearing, look at the amendments, and then we will set it over for another date. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3362. Mr. Putman, you'd like to give us a brief introduction?
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, there are amendments being proposed to this bill, but basically what it does is sets forth conditions under which a manufacturer or distributor can drop a dealer of this product.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for scheduling this public hearing on this bill. This bill is important to many, many Oregon businesses that are involved in representing different products in commerce. Mr. Chairman, I would point out that this bill, and I'd like to go through it provision by provision for the benefit of the committee, but I would point out that this bill is designed to give reasonable protections to Oregon businesses that are involved as dealers of a variety of different manufactured products. This bill would apply to a number of different industries. Obviously, one that I have some personal knowledge of is the office and printing equipment industry, but also certainly would apply to things like refrigeration equipment, air conditioning equipment, plumbing equipment and goods, electrical goods, a wide variety of products that are sold in the stream of commerce. And what this bill is designed to do is it's designed to give some reasonable safeguards and protections, particularly to Oregon businesses that are dealers of a variety of different tangible goods. I'd like to briefly go through the bill, and my testimony hopefully has been handed out, which goes through the bill section by section. And I'd like to take a few moments to do that for the benefit of the committee. Section 1 is definitional, and it defines what a manufacturer is, what a distributor is, and what a dealer is, and what products would be covered by this bill. And specifically, this bill is designed to affect the relationships between manufacturers and dealers or distributors and dealers. It does not apply relationships between manufacturers and distributors. A dealer, as it's defined in the bill, is any person who purchases products from a manufacturer, distributor, or importer for sale to the general public. So a dealer is typically as one who is selling to end users. Section 2 sets up a requirement of good faith in dealing. It says that the parties in relationships between manufacturers and dealers, both parties must exercise good faith. It doesn't have a specific direct meaning, but it does have a certain legal connotation that says that the parties need to use good faith in terms of being honest and not duplicitous in terms of how they engage in business together. Section 3 relates to termination provisions and states in paragraph 1 that if the manufacturer or distributor is terminating the dealer without cause, in other words, the dealer has complied with all requirements of the relationship, all requirements of the contract between them, that the manufacturer must give the dealer 12 months' notice. And paragraph 2 says if the termination is for cause, in other words, possibly the dealer has violated some provision of an agreement between the parties, then the manufacturer must give the dealer 30 days' notice and an opportunity to cure or an opportunity to remedy the breach. And if the dealer remedies within 30 days, the termination is void. Section 4 talks about dealer remedies for violation of this prospective statute. It would allow the dealer to get injunctive relief to enjoin the manufacturer. Secondly, it would allow the dealer damages for including lost profits if the manufacturer violates the statute. Third, it states that any actions must be brought within a two-year statute of limitations and that attorney fees and costs will be awarded to the prevailing party. And fourth, it allows a dealer who believes that a manufacturer has violated the statute to bring an action in the jurisdiction in which the dealer resides. Section 5 talks about actions that are unlawful by manufacturers and distributors. One would be to require the dealer to waive jury trial. Secondly, would be to prevent a dealer from bringing a suit in a form otherwise available under the law. It's common in these kinds of contracts where a manufacturer might be based, for example, in New York, and the dealers in Oregon, to require the dealer to bring any action under the contract in New York, even though the manufacturer is doing business in Oregon. This would prevent the manufacturer from requiring that as a condition of the contract. And then paragraph 3, requiring the dealer to submit to arbitration or other binding alternate dispute resolution. Often the manufacturer will require the dealer to submit to binding arbitration, for example, in New York City, and take away the opportunity for the dealer to bring a suit in Oregon seeking a jury trial. This provision would make it so that the dealer would have that right to seek a jury trial where they do business in the state of Oregon. Section 6 says any manufacturer distributor who terminates relationship with the dealer must provide parts and supplies to the dealer to meet the needs of the dealer's customers following termination, and those parts and supplies must be sold at normal dealer price. I know of situations in my industry where manufacturers have canceled dealers on 30 or 45 days notice after years of a relationship and then refused to sell the dealer parts or supplies the dealer needed to be able to service its customer base. The effect of that is to steal the dealer's business. I know of one specific case, in fact, where a manufacturer canceled a dealer after a dealer had represented a product well for several years and then refused to sell the parts to the dealer that the dealer needed to service its customer, and then the manufacturer came in direct, set up their own direct operation, and in essence stole the dealer's customers away from the dealer. This would require the manufacturer distributor to provide those parts and supplies at normal dealer price so that the dealer can service its customers. Section 7 says any purchase quotas in a manufacturer-dealer relationship must be mutually agreed to, including any changes in the quota. Section 8 of the contract says contracts in place between manufacturers and dealers automatically renew unless timely notice of non-renewal is provided. If you think about the requirement of a one-year notice of cancellation without cause, well, an easy way for a manufacturer to terminate a dealer would be simply to wait until 30 or 15 days prior to the contract termination and simply say, send a letter saying we're not going to renew your contract. What Section 8 does is it takes care of that, and it requires that the manufacturer give a one-year notice of non-renewal if the dealer has complied with all the terms and provisions of the contract. Section 9 excludes motor vehicle dealerships and motor fuel franchises. That's because motor vehicle dealers and the motor fuel industry already have their own sets of regulations in Oregon that condition that relationship that have been in statute for many, many years. And Section 10 says the law is prospective only. Actually, I didn't ask for Section 10, and I'm going to have some amendments drafted which will say the statute would become effective within so many days of passage. Many contracts just continue to run, and if we just make the law prospective in terms of new contracts that are signed, it would not correct imbalances in relationship for existing. Mr. Chairman, I will bring forth another amendment which will say that the contract will be effective on a date certain and that it will apply to relationships effective that date. I've also brought with me Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments simply add some language on page 1, line 19. Specifically, the Dash 1 amendments state that notwithstanding the terms of any contract, it shall be unlawful for any man to contribute to cancel, terminate, or refuse to continue any relationship with the dealer without cause unless the manufacturer or distributor gives at least 12 months written notice to the dealer. And then the second amendment from Dash 1 says a dealer may use prior sales and profits as evidence of profits lost as a result of illegal conduct by a manufacturer. It gets to an evidentiary point. Since you would be allowed under this bill to get damages, including lost profits, this is, from an evidentiary standpoint, a dealer can bring in a history of sales and profits as evidence as to what its future profits would have been if a manufacturer violates this statute. And then the third amendment, the dash one amendment, says the manufacturer distributor shall make the parts or supplies available to the dealer at the regular vehicle price. That relates to the provision earlier in the bill where it said that a manufacturer dealer must provide parts and supplies to the dealer necessary to service its customers following termination. And then the dash two amendment simply exempt motor vehicle dealerships and motor fuel franchises. That was requested from the folks who represent that industry, and it makes sense because there's already separate statutes dealing with motor vehicle and motor fuel dealership agreements and relationships. Mr. Chairman, I think this bill is justified in terms of protecting a small business in Oregon, to give reasonable protections to small businesses that often are representing products that are sold by international manufacturers. It provides some balance to that relationship. And it's also important from a standpoint of consumer protection. When a dealer goes out and sells products and establishes a customer base, it's important that the dealer have a flow of product to be able to take care of those customers, particularly as it relates to parts and supplies. This bill addresses that and provides some protections both to the end public and to the dealers that represent these products. And I think this bill is a balanced approach to deal with that relationship and provide some reasonable protections. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
In the case of supplying parts and supplies, what happens in the case of the dealer discontinues a line of product? Does he still have to maintain the parts then to his dealers from the producer?
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, typically what happens there, if a dealer decides he's selling brand X and he wants to start selling brand Y for whatever reason, typically in our industry, because the products we sell require a continual flow of service and supplies and parts, you continue to purchase those parts and supplies from the manufacturer of brand X to be able to service your customers. And also, typically in our industry, you have maintenance agreements that could run from anywhere from 1 to 5 years where you've made an obligation, a commitment to service that product, and it's important that you're able to get the parts and the supplies you need to provide that service. So you would continue to buy those parts and supplies and service those customers.
Well, what I'm worried about is maybe I don't understand the wording enough. This isn't my expertise of law, but the manufacturer at some point needs to be able to terminate that line. That product. I mean, there's progress in improvements in product, and most manufacturers, they need to be able to terminate also the parts. Otherwise, they're going to have a huge inventory, and yeah. I'm worried that we haven't got that in here.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, what this bill says is that the manufacturer has to continue to provide parts and supplies following termination for the life of the equipment that the dealer has placed out in the field. So typically, and of course this will vary industry from industry, but typically equipment in the office equipment industry will last anywhere from 4 to 8 years, for example. So it's not unusual to be servicing machines that you sold 6 or 7 or 8 years ago. Although that diminishes over time as those machines are replaced with newer machines, but the manufacturers all pretty much recognize the responsibility to have those parts available so that customers can get service. What this bill says is that at the point of termination or following termination, a manufacturer cannot refuse to provide those parts to a dealer who was an authorized dealer representing those products.
Well, I can see a problem because different industries work different ways. And maybe in your industry in my industry, we buy electronic equipment and it's always a problem. Because electronic dealers are discontinuing radars, discontinuing sonars, pieces of equipment like that. Some vessels never upgrade, but yet they think they need to get parts. Take Raytheon, for example. There's a Raytheon fathometer built back in 1955. Well, Raytheon's long since discontinued parts. If this bill was implemented, they would have to go back and maintain parts on their shelf for possibly 30 to 50 years. And I see a little bit of a problem depending on the type of equipment. And I'm not sure how, there may be a way to word it out in there, but I think you need to have some
protection for the manufacturers in those cases, so they need to have some realistic timeframe.
I believe Representative Thompson and Representative Witt, you're kind of discussing two different things. Representative Witt is discussing when a manufacturer terminates agreement with a dealer, and you're talking about when a manufacturer quits making a product, discontinues a line of product. I think it's two different issues, and I think you're right. I think it needs to be addressed in the bill, but Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, if you look at Section 6 on line 25 on page 2 of the bill, it says available to the dealer during the expected useful life of the product sold by the dealer. So, you know, I think that language says that the expected useful life. I mean, there's always someone who wants to take the product and make it last forever. That's not reasonably the expected useful life. So this bill's not designed to make it hard for manufacturers to carry parts forever on their shelves. That's not the purpose of the bill. The purpose of this specific provision is to say if you've been selling this product through an authorized dealer and that dealer's terminated for whatever reason, those parts need to be made available to that dealer just like they'd be made available to a new dealer for that kind of a product so that that original dealer can protect its relationship and fulfill its obligations with its customer.
President Thompson.
In most cases, there's considered to be a depreciable life in taxes. Would you consider that as a reasonable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, yeah, I would. You know, if a product has a 5-year depreciation schedule, I think that's a reasonable basis. You know, my experience has been, except in very unusual circumstances, manufacturers do have parts available because they see it as an essential component of customer service, you know, to make sure their products that are out in the field that have their name on it, that people can get parts to repair it. But no, I wouldn't have any objection to that kind of an interpretation or amendment.
Representative Witt, possibly another way to describe the language, it would be to say that as long as the parts or products are made available to other dealers, they would have to be made available to a discontinued dealer.
And that would be fine too, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that's...
That would just require them as long to, not... hold an inventory of parts for people they have terminated agreements with, but as long as they're making parts available to other dealers, they should also make them available to that dealer.
That's certainly the intent of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is that Representative Lundquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't here, and you may have already answered it. How many states have this kind of law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lundquist, there's a number of different laws in different states. The state that has kind of known as having the model laws, Wisconsin. But I might also add, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lundquist, that a number of states have different laws for certain industries. For example, Oregon has a law on auto dealers, on motor fuels, on you know, a few different industries that have carved out certain statutory provisions in the law. What this bill does is it takes a broader approach.
With the motor, the ones already have a law. Was that, you know, was that brought forth by the industry, or was that the legislature saying you have to do it this way?
No, I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lundquist, I think that the motor vehicle law, for example, in Oregon, I think goes back to like the 50s, and I think was largely driven by the auto dealers, the independent dealers, to give them some reasonable protections vis-a-vis the manufacturers.
Again, you may have covered this, but just from a broad, just from a, I guess, a philosophical question or point of view, I like to not get involved in telling business how to run their business. 30 seconds of why we ought to do that.
Sure. Maybe even a few more than 30 seconds, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman. I can give a couple examples, okay, that I'm aware of, for example, in our industry. I'm aware of one manufacturer who, from overseas, came to the United States in the late 80s, set up a distribution network, got dealers to make significant commitments to represent its products, which had not been sold previously. In many areas of the country, as the dealers became successful in terms of marketing those products, in the meantime, the manufacturer had a change in its leadership in the United States, brought in a new president, new management team. They decided they wanted to go direct and pick up that base of customers that the dealers had established. They started canceling dealers all over the United States and refused to sell them parts and supplies and went in with direct operations, in essence, stealing away the dealer's business from the dealers because the dealers couldn't get the parts and supplies to service the customers. Occasionally those kinds of companies appear on the surface, and what they do is they totally undermine the investment the dealer has made to represent the product, and by the way, also create a lot of confusion in the marketplace for customers, because typically in many of these industries you have extended warranties, you have maintenance agreements, and if you can't get the parts supplies to service the customer, you start breaching on those agreements, and the end users end up getting hurt in that kind of a relationship. So I think what this bill does is it says, hey, as pure as classic contract law might be, and says that government should stay out and parties make their own agreements, that in all kinds of examples, we have gone in and we put some reasonable protections and reasonable requirements into contractual relationships so that there is at least some level playing field, both for the benefit of the people that engage in the contracts, but even more so for the customers, the end users who buy products and require on some kind of a consistency from a business in terms of providing service for those products.
Go ahead. And not attorney like you are, could those contracts specify that to start with, like the example you gave with the dealers? Could that have been in the contracts if they wanted it?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lundquist, in an ideal world, yes. Just to use as a personal example, I have contracts with Xerox, Ricoh, Toshiba, and companies that are 30, 40, 50 billion in sales. The reality of it is they have specific contracts. They will not change one word on that contract. So in certain industries, you're dealing with such large companies that there is no way they will enter a contractual negotiation with any balance. I mean, this is the required contract period. And if you're going to be in this industry, you've got to sign these required contracts. And these contracts almost all look the same. They have the exact same provisions relative to termination. They have the exact same provisions relative to aftermarket product parts and supplies, jurisdiction and venue issues relative to where if there's disputes under the contracts where you can bring an action. And, of course, these contracts are written by their attorneys, designed to put them in the very best position. And frankly, an independent dealer who's 1/100th of the size of some of these manufacturers does not have any ability to negotiate these contracts to put reasonable protections into the contract. And that's what brought this bill. I mean, it's not dissimilar from what auto dealers faced when they put their bill in the statutes of Oregon, years ago. It's to provide some reasonable basis. And part of the justification, in fact, I would suggest a large part of the justification is protecting users in terms of being able to get service and warranties honored and, be able to buy a product and be assured that they can be properly serviced over the longer term.
Any further questions? Representative Witt, I heard your answer that you don't know how many other states have this type of legislation. Is that true? You don't know if there are some, but you don't know how many.
Yeah, I know. I know there's a number of states that have different parts of this kind of a statute. Wisconsin is kind of the model state that has taken these kinds of protections.
Okay. Does this, or if it does, how does it affect the provision between Oregon manufacturers and out-of-state dealers of their product? Does it have any effect with them?
Well, this bill would apply to relationships that are controlled by Oregon law, and it would apply to doing business in Oregon. So this would not impact that.
Okay, so as long as an Oregon manufacturer is selling their products to dealers outside the state, they wouldn't have to comply with this law.
Mr. Chairman, my immediate response to that would be if Oregon law is not controlling and the business is not being done in Oregon, it would not be subject to Oregon statutes. So only relationships that would be subject to Oregon statute would be subject to this law. Well, it would primarily be businesses that are buying product in Oregon.
In your example where you said that a lot of manufacturers will make you as a dealer go to New York to litigate because that's where the manufacturer is, and if you use that example in reverse, if you have a manufacturer in Oregon who requires his dealers to come to Oregon to litigate, would this law then cover that agreement?
I think if, Mr. Chairman, I think if the contract said that Oregon law will be prevailing in terms of the interpretation of the agreement between the parties, then I believe the statute would have put effect that relationship.
Okay. Another question, and you probably don't know the answer to this, and maybe they can speak to it when they get up here, but why are the beer and wine people here in force today on this issue?
Mr. Chairman, I should point out a couple things. Number one, Mr. Miner of the manufactured home industry asked to be exempt from the statute, and I told him he could get amendments drafted to that, and he could speak specifically to that. And, you know, this committee can make a decision as to if they should be exempt or not from the bill. I don't have any objection to it personally. I mean, it's a decision for the committee to make. The beer and wine industry representatives contacted me, and my understanding is that the beer industry would like to be exempt from the statute. There appears to be some difference of opinion on the wine industry.
Okay, so that's the reason for the dash twos is because the manufactured home people wanted to be exempt. It seems to me that every manufacturer would be coming to you saying, I want to be exempt. How are you going to pick and choose which ones you're going to let in, which ones you're going to let out?
Well, Mr. Chairman, ultimately that's a decision here for the committee. You know, I've had a few different industries come to me, and I said, you know, go ahead and have amendments drafted if you'd like, and take it down to the committee. I do have to state that industries do have certain peculiarities about them, and those that have come forward and asked for some kind of adjustment or exemption from the statute, I think it may be legitimate, it might not be legitimate, depending upon the circumstances of that industry. I have had a number of members of the lobby come to me and said they floated it around their who they represent this bill, and that a number of them have told me there's been no objections to the bill.
Obviously, maybe you would prefer that Mr. Miner speak on his own behalf, but in your opinion, why was his argument so compelling that you agreed to offer the amendments to take him out?
Mr. Chairman, I can't say his arguments were compelling. All I said is, Mr. Miner, go ahead and get your amendments drafted and explain to the committee as to why you believe your industry shouldn't be covered. And, you know, I really didn't make a decision based upon any kind of a compelling argument. I trust the committee to make that decision.
So this was the dash two is actually his amendment, not yours, then?
That's his amendment, yes.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could I ask one more, sir?
Sure, Representative Thompson.
In the states that have implemented this kind of law, has it increased the number of lawsuits in this area? What's been the effect of that toward?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, you know, I don't have any information specifically on that in terms of what it's done in terms of lawsuits. I would think, if anything, it would lower the amount of lawsuits because it puts all the parties on notice that there's a certain good faith dealing requirement and a certain balance to the relationship by law that you have to live with. And I think what leads to lawsuits, frankly, is when dealers get surprised and they feel like the rug's been pulled out under them without any kind of notice or justifications. That's what typically leads to lawsuits.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Mr. Putman, or is it, I think through legislative research, there's a way to find that information from existing states. Is that something that can
be done, yes.
And found out what the effect has been as toward the kinds of lawsuits and the amounts that have been, is it a positive or negative effect in this area?
Well,
I don't know.
I'll take a shot at it, Chairman, Representative, see what I can find.
We'll ask Mr. Putman to do a little research in that area. Thank you. Representative Witt, do you have someone else you brought with you'd like to speak on behalf of this bill before we go on to the people who want to?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I have Mr. Dennis Rossman from Advanced Office Systems, who is a Tualatin-based company in the office equipment industry, who has come to give some testimony today.
Thank you. Please come forward, Mr. Rossman. You're welcome to stay there, Mr. Representative Witt, or yes,
I'll stay for a couple of minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, please state your name for the record.
My name is Dennis Rossman. I'm president of Advanced Office Systems.
Do you have testimony you'd like to give?
I would. Chairman Beyer, I think, you know, I'm excited about the bill for two direct reasons. One is that I've been in privately held corporation in the state of Oregon for 8 years, and I started from zero. I basically have been involved in dealer associations in my particular products since day one. And this kind of protection has not even been around for a group of dealers throughout the United States. And the basic reasoning I like here is that our particular case with our particular manufacturers, and we represent 8 different manufacturers in order to provide goods and services to customers, is that the interruption to customers is such a dynamic. I could pick, we have 6,800 customers, and I could pick 6,800 cases of how they would be disrupted. And you might even have a mental case of sometime when your businesses or people that you know have had goods and services all of a sudden yanked, and the disruption it causes is a ripple effect that goes right back to the consumer. You know, and we live with it because we don't have, you know, any of these protections. Something as new as March 31st, I had one manufacturer come to us, our company, and simply say, you know, you're going to have to order $138,000 worth of merchandise, or I'm just going to cancel you. I'm going to just send you a 30-day notice. You know, that's the sales presentation. And really, that's uncalled for. I mean, it suits no particular purpose to better serve either my business or my customers. And I think that's the key. You know, if we're all given the same level playing field that we... and we can conduct our business and affairs that provide goods, a relationship to a customer that help them get through the day, you know, that's all we're looking for. And that's what I think is important here, is that it really protects the customer.
Thank you. Do you have a question?
Yes. I think that customer protection obviously is the point. It protects the customer's if the manufacturer does it. However, if the dealer, and in my industry, in ag industry, our biggest situation has been simply that the dealers are gone because they can't make it work any longer. And consequently, financially, they can't make it work any longer. And this bill does nothing from that standpoint. Am I not right? In other words, if the dealer decides they want to quit, they quit for financial reasons, or whatever reason, I guess, but primarily financial reasons. The customers still have the same relationship.
Chair Beyer, Representative Lindquist, if I understand your question correctly, you were talking about the dealer, you know, just deciding that he can't financially do business anymore. I think that points to passing this bill, because this would, you know, the more that manufacturers want to pull the plug on dealers, that would put more dealers out of business. But you see what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying, from my understanding. All I'm saying is that it's not that the manufacturer wanted to pull any deal, anything on the dealers made it harder. It's simply the industry, you know, can't support that many dealers anymore. And so the dealers are just gone. And those of us that are still in the industry have difficult times. And I'm not even suggesting that the government does that, but I just don't know. I was asking whether this bill does anything for that aspect.
I can't, Chair Beyer, Representative Lindquist, I really can't make a judgment on your industry. I would say this bill helps support my industry, though.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Rossman, so basically what you're saying, if I understand it right, is that the only protection you have, or essentially you have no protection from the dictates of a national or multinational company that comes in and you get into a relationship with, except what they are willing to give you in a contract. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And my follow-up
question.
So what you're thinking that this bill does is it simply gives you a set of parameters for which that company can deal with you here in Oregon. Is that right?
Correct.
Thank you very much for coming forward today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'm going to see what the other side has to say. I I guess we'll go right to the beer and wine people. Gary, Sandra, and Charlie, you want to come up first? You want to come up with the panel? Start with the wine. Is Gary here?
He's up.
You decided you didn't want to testify after all, huh?
Sandra. You can bring the third chair up. There's one right there.
I'm listening.
Would you go ahead and start off, Charlie, if you want?
Mr. Chair, my name is Charles Williamson. I'm an attorney and lobbyist from Portland. I represent Valley Wine Company. Valley's a subsidiary of the Gallo Wine Company. I wasn't sure exactly what this bill did, so I didn't prepare anything in writing, but historically in our industry, we've had battles over the last 20 years over whether a distributor would have an exclusive territory and whether there would be certain restrictions on terminating a distributor. I'm informed, I mean, this bill deals with, on its face, whether Valley Wine could stop serving Safeway or Fred Meyer. Those would, I think, under the definition of the bill, would be the dealer. But as Mr. Romaine has pointed out to me, that most distributors make some dock sales to the public. So they would probably be dealers, too, or could be dealers under the bill. Thus, a manufacturer, the bill would also stop manufacturers from possibly terminating distributors. At least that's Mr. Romaine's interpretation of the bill. And I assume that that would be the situation in other industries. If people ever sell wholesale, they bought from the manufacturer for sale to the public, and so that they could never be terminated except with this one-year notice. But over the years, we've sort of had a truce or an uneasy truce where because of the bottle bill and the need for distributors and manufacturers to take back items, beer has been covered by a franchise exclusive territory bill, and wine has not. With respect to the effect of the bill primarily in our industry, under OLCC regulations, we have to sell wine to everybody. We have to sell for the same price to everybody, Fred Meyer or the local mom-and-pop store. So we're not cutting off any retailers of wine. We do also have a requirement in our industry that the purchasers pay cash, so we don't even cut people off for failure to pay their bill. They always pay because they pay upon delivery. So really, with respect to the beer and wine industry, I think there's a good reason to exempt them. Generally, with respect to this bill, I think there's some things that the committee should consider with respect to lawsuits and the obligation of good faith. Oregon courts do already imply a covenant of good faith and fair dealing in contracts, but it is limited by court decisions. This good faith decision basically gives a 12-person jury the right to decide whether you complied with some very nebulous term of a contract. And so I think it would have a tremendous impact on increased litigation. Anytime you opened up a new dealer anywhere nearby the old dealer, anytime you stop dealing with a dealer, anytime in our industry, even if we have a limited run of wine and we put it into specialty stores because that's the place we think it would sell best, could we be sued for bad faith by Costco or other stores because there's not enough of the wine? Did we exercise bad faith in that choice? With respect to the venue and saying that you can't put arbitration or arbitration requirement into a contract or require that the venue be here, I think that, you know, Oregon has some fairly large manufacturers such as Nike, Tektronix, Intel. They all, I'm sure, have that clause in their contract that if they sell an oscilloscope or whatever they sell to someone in Massachusetts and there's going to be a lawsuit about it, it's going to be here in Oregon. And you're going to, if you pass this law, you would invalidate all of those companies' contracts with their dealers, wherever they are. I guess lastly I'd point out, I do not see any consumers here complaining that they've been cut off because of the lack of this bill. And we just had one person, and certainly Valley Wine would have no objection if you want to pass this bill and apply it to the photocopy industry. But to apply it to everybody when you really don't know what it's doing, we think is going too far. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer your questions.
Go ahead, Gary or Senator.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling here today representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. And as written, House Bill 3362 poses serious concerns for OWA. And as Representative Witt indicated, we have submitted an amendment to Legislative Council that would exclude the Oregon wine and wine grape industry from the provisions of this bill, and the adoption of that amendment would satisfy our concerns. By way of background, there are 125 licensed wineries in Oregon as of 1998, which compares to only 66 a decade earlier. Oregon ranks second nationally in the number of wineries. However, only 13 of those wineries produce more than 40,000 gallons of wine, which means they're all really quite small, and getting their products to customers is critical to their success. Most of them aren't big enough even to attract a distributor, let alone to have a bad relationship with one. Most often, they are required to make the connections with a supermarket or a restaurant or a specialty wine shop on their own. They only dream about having the problem of a relationship with a distributor. Our reading of the definition of dealers in House Bill 3362 indicates that it would include food and beverage retailers, wine merchants, restaurants, and other drinking establishments. The bill would place constraints on contractual relationships for which contracting parties could not escape. Wineries and possibly wine grape producers would most likely be deemed manufacturers under terms of this bill. But depending upon the nature of their distribution and sales, wineries also might be considered distributors or dealers and subject to contractual constraints regarding wine that isn't even theirs. Whatever the cause of this bill, Oregon wineries don't possess the market power of manufacturers this bill seems aimed at addressing. The one-year termination requirement would make it very difficult to end a distributorship arrangement that isn't productive. Even the for-cause termination provisions would be cumbersome to invoke for small wineries and wine grape producers. I might note, as Mr. Williamson indicated, that the subject of a franchise law for wineries in this state has been before the legislature, and the legislature has acted not to impose such requirements. So that is the standing policy of this state. And we would hope that this would not be a backdoor effort in attempt to impose franchise-like requirements on Oregon wineries. For these reasons, we ask adoption of our language to exclude Oregon's wine and wine grape industry from provisions of the bill. Thank you.
When was the franchise law bill for the legislature? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, it regularly appears and has been routinely defeated. It's a perennial.
Is it here this time?
I haven't seen it in its direct form.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you.
If you have, I guess, new things to add, we're a little out of time. We have four sessions at 10. We've got a whole bunch of witnesses and many more bills. So.
Yes, thank you. My name is Sandra Bishop. I represent the Wine Institute. We're here today to support the Oregon Wine Growers Association amendment to exclude wine, the wine industry, from this bill. We need to make sure that it excludes the industry and not simply Oregon wineries. I believe it does, but we haven't seen the actual language from the LC draft. The sales and distribution of wine is different and distinct from other industries. In wine, manufacturers, distributors, and dealers have the possibility of selling directly to retailers. So I'm not going to go through the whole system, but it definitely can affect us quite adversely. As Mr. Williamson said, OLCC has in place uniform pricing standards. This bill is not going to benefit the consumer at all. It's actually going to be detrimental to consumer choice. Restriction of trade is a problem for wineries because thousands of wineries produce millions of gallons of product, and each small winery produces anywhere from 6 to 12 different products. whereas the beer industry, there are five brewers that produce billions with a B, billions of gallons. So it makes sense to have the beer in territory. It doesn't make sense for wine. Final comment, wine is a perishable agricultural product. This bill was never designed to cover those sort of products. I hope that you can see clear to exempt it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman,
over the
list. Mr. Simon, you might just ask anyone who wants to be included in the bill to come forward.
I think that would shorten the list considerably. John Powell, Paul Manuel, together. And in the essence of time, could you, obviously we're not going to move this bill today. We've heard of at least one new set of amendments coming forward. State a willingness to work with the sponsor and tell us what your opinion is and what.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Miller Brewing Company, and we've done just that, Mr. Chairman. The sponsor of the bill has authorized amendments that are in council now to exempt beer. Beer is subject to existing franchise laws in ORS 474. That law is very sophisticated. It requires basically cause to terminate and in most cases to purchase the value when termination takes place. So as a result, this bill would be a minor type of a franchise law compared to the one that beer is subject to. So we're simply asking that we keep the agreements that we currently have in statute and be exempted from this one.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, and I'm actually the one who drafted both the automobile franchise law and the beer franchise law. The auto franchise law went into effect in 1979. When I was a mere child, I was hired by the auto dealers to put that one through, and then the beer franchise law went through 1989. The reason that you have franchise law, we are in favor of exempting beer because there is a specific franchise law already that regulates in detail the relationship. We are not in favor of exempting wine because there is no law that regulates it and should be treated just like any other product out there. Earlier testimony brought up, it's the classic way you defeat a bill. You bring up a red herring that has nothing to do with it, and then you kind of knock that red herring down, and that red herring is exclusive territories. This bill has nothing to do with exclusive territories. It has everything to do with simply giving people notice. It allows for dueling a product. You could have 40 distributors of the same product in the same city. It doesn't make any difference. What it does, it simply says that you have to give somebody notice and sufficient notice if you're going to discontinue them. And we definitely support that. It does limit litigation. We can prove to you that with the beer franchise law. Frankly, the reason we put that in, one of the reasons we put it in, is the fact that when people were terminated, when somebody took a brand from another person, there was always litigation about this thing because nobody knew what the rules were. When we put the franchise law in, we just really stopped having litigation. All of a sudden, everybody knew what the rules were, and when product moved from one distributor to another distributor, it was basically sold for a fair price, and it just stopped the court problem. What you have, the reason you do this is because you have, especially in modern times, a totally unequal bargaining position between manufacturers and your local distributors. Without going into more detail, I will work very closely with Representative Witt and others on this bill, and if you see the need for the bill and the willingness to pass it, we will work with you in getting it through. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Putman, ask a question.
Mr. Romaine, would you have a source of information to respond to Representative Thompson's question about whether similar laws have generated or reduced the number of lawsuits in other states?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Putnam, I know in Oregon it has. I don't have a source of information besides the wholesaler organizations in different states. A lot of other states have different kinds. Washington State has a franchise law that applies generically across the board. Basically, it's just simply a notice provision where you have to give a certain amount of notice and certain procedures to go through. There are many other states that have specific beer franchise laws, and I know in the beer industry, they really have led to a limited amount of litigation. But that's really the one I'm most familiar with. I haven't played with the auto industry and well, 20 years now.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Thompson?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don Miner. Mark Nelson, you want to take time?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Good morning. I assume the dash twos are yours?
I believe they are. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufacturing Housing Association to speak to this bill and to request the amendment you have before you. Our association is broadly representative of the entire manufactured housing industry. We represent factories as well as dealers. In fact, our board of directors is dominated by dealers. The current president of the association is a dealer. I circulated this bill to them and to seek their input. A good, obedient employee would. They had asked that it not include our industry. They believe that our relationships between factories and dealers are best worked out by contract. In those cases where dealers have felt that they were put upon by a manufacturer, they have resorted to the common law and have done well. In our industry, there are dealers who are larger than manufacturers. This isn't a case where we're dealing with large international producers, although there are some very large producers. But generally, they've been able to bargain out their relationships, and we're content with the status quo. I think that there is a concern that should this go forward, that at some point manufacturers will look for symmetry in the law, and they will want a provision that says and a retailer can't cancel a manufacturer without a year's notice, an opportunity for that manufacturer to cure his shortcomings. So, in conclusion, we'd like to see the status quo, at least as it regards our industry, remain. I thank you for your time.
Questions? Are most of your manufacturers also located in the state of Oregon?
Most of them have factories in the state of Oregon or surrounding in Boise or Southwest Washington, although most of them are national producers.
Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing Anheuser-Busch and Southland Corporation 7-Eleven. As has been indicated by Mr. Powell, we certainly would agree with an amendment which would exclude Anheuser-Busch and from the provisions of this franchise bill, or it's really much bigger than a franchise bill. I want to speak more to the relationships between 7-Eleven and its franchisees. We have 142 franchisees in the state of Oregon. We have a contractual relationship with those franchisees. This bill is a very, very broad bill. It doesn't just deal with the relationship between franchisees. It obviously deals with the relationship between every single manufacturer, distributor, and retailer, whether you're talking about high-tech, you're talking about Hewlett-Packard or Xerox or whoever you're talking about. This is a very, very broad bill. And I'd like to point out it's written in a very, very general kind of way. And to give an example, if you go back and check ORS or Chapter 474, which is the beer franchise statute, you will find it deals with a lot of issues very, very specifically. And what probably causes us more concern than anything else is the language on line 17 and line 21, which states, notwithstanding the terms of any contract. We have a contractual relationship with every one of our franchisees, which deals with the minute types of details in terms of disagreements that you can enter into and tries to deal with that through the contract form. And that when there are disputes, the contract dictates how you're going to handle those particular disputes. The particular language found on line 23 where we reference for cause does not define what cause is, and the bill does not allow for termination for good cause. That could include, for example, compliance with any material lawful requirement of the franchise agreement. In other words, if you have a contract that lays out relationships between, in our case, Southland 7-Eleven Corporation and the franchisees, and those particular provisions are violated by the franchisee, or in fact, violated by the Southland Corporation, this does not allow for us to deal with franchisee for cause relating to any kind of breach in contract. Nor does it allow for a list of situations which are a franchisee may be terminated immediately. Let me give you some of those. without written notice or the opportunity to cure. In other words, these are the type of situations where we would want to terminate immediately, in which we have this in our contract, including bankruptcy or insolvency of a franchisee. We should be able to come in under that kind of situation. This doesn't deal with that kind of situation. The voluntary abandonment of the franchisee, mutual agreement of the two parties, material misrepresentation by the franchisee, repeated failure to comply with material provisions of the franchise agreement, lawful seizure or foreclosure by government. In other words, these are very specific kinds of things that you usually find in contracts dealing with franchisees that allow you and set out those kinds of rights. A perfect example is if you have theft. We don't want to give 30 days notice of cause when there's theft, when there's clear, when we have discovered that there is actual theft that's taken place by a franchisee.
Mr. Nelson, would you be willing to work with the sponsor of the bill and to address some of your concerns? And we will, let's say we're not going to move the bill today, so if it comes back again, we can maybe address some of your concerns at that time.
Now, I'd just like to conclude that it is a very broad bill with some very general provisions, which leads to many, many questions that we will have in other manufacturers.
Thank you. Questions? Any questions?
No.
Thank you. Betsy Earls and Julie Brandes. And if Representative Butler's your aide is in the room or listening on up in their office, we will go to HCR 74 next if he is here. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandes with Associated Oregon Industries and our AOI Retail Council. For those of you who are not aware, AOI is divided into a series of committees. And one committee that we have is our retail committee. And this is primarily national retailers who have worked through AOI into this this committee to work on retail-specific issues. We met on Thursday, and these retailers are primarily the dealers that this bill is attempting to address and to help. And nevertheless, they do not support the bill. I think Representative Lundquist summed it up the reasons why best when he said, "You know, why is there an important reason for the government to start getting involved with these contracts?" Of course, that's not a direct quote, Representative Lundquist, but I think that sums it up. Further, they voiced concern about setting precedent for additional government involvement into these contracts. We also have alerted all of our AOI members about this bill just as of last Friday, and so I'm sure we can come up with some additional concerns we have about the bill, and I've listened to a great deal of concerns about possible exemptions today, and I'm sure we can also come up with some exemptions to the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls from AOI. I think Julie spoke mostly to the retail side of AOI, but as she mentioned, we have alerted all of our members to this bill. We are gravely concerned about the bill and are not sure if it can be organized so that we should be able to support it as manufacturers. However, just to let you know, we will talk to our members and see if there's anything that can be done.
Thank you. Just get a sponsor, or the sponsor representative still in the room. He's heard the concerns of that the people have addressed, and we'll probably get together with him and work some things out if possible. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
What
was that? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 3362? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3362. Representative Butler is here now, so we will move on to a public hearing on numbers right here. HJR 74, open a public hearing. Mr. Putman, would you like to give us a brief overview of what the rest of the has come forward?
Pretty straightforward. It sets up an interim committee to study the organization of the Department of Consumer Business Services and to recommend operational or structural changes.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Butler. I'm the representative of House District 60, which represents all of Mount Hur, Harney, Lake, and half of Klamath County.
You can just say a third of the state.
About a third of the state. We're from that rural portion of the state where, as long as I've got Representative Lundquist here, between Representative Lundquist and I, we represent half of the state, and then it takes 58 people to take care of the rest of the state. So,
I'm not sure that was a compliment or not.
We do a pretty good job taking care of rural Oregon between the two of us. Thank you. Members of the committee, the House Joint Resolution 74 is brought to you today with the anticipation that we could continue the effects of Senate Bill 35 from the 1995 session to continue to study the potential of not just study, but to proceed forward with more of the opportunities to privatize some of the activities that are presently being administered under the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This particular bill would give us an opportunity to, in the preamble, to either examine these these services for delivery on a regional basis or on private or by private entities. Senate Bill 35, to my knowledge, was pretty efficient to take a look at the function of certain departments and to help in the supervision of those and try to look for regional or private entity approaches to the delivery of these services to the private sector, to providing consumers a better opportunity and a better option in rural Oregon. The committee would basically have an opportunity to study some of the others' services as well as the basically returning and reporting how it's doing relative to the Oregon Building Codes Division, the opportunity to return and report. Our stewardship as members of the legislature is extremely important. I don't want to seem in any way that I'm feeling defamatory towards Director Greenfield. I think, as a matter of fact, that a great deal of the progress is being made under the new and being encouraged by Director Mike Greenfield from the DCBS is something to be encouraged. So House Joint Resolution basically was introduced to take a look at the opportunity to continue to do what Senate Bill 35 from the 95 session did. I don't want to get any anecdotal problems that we've got, but there are some difficulties in implementing it, and I think that perhaps Director Greenfield recognizes what those are. He's been able to examine from a very positive approach and aspect of taking a look at getting some of this done, and perhaps we're already headed in a new direction. And so I offer you House Joint Resolution 74 for the opportunity to continue the process of examining some very specific areas, including the privatization, including regionalization, and then returning and reporting within a period of time the stewardship which we would have should you feel inclined to go ahead and pass House Joint Resolution 74.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Any questions? Have you seen the fiscal? You are aware of the fiscal?
Yes, I am aware of the fiscal, of the potential fiscal, and the potential fiscal does take into consideration that the 8-member interim legislative committee would study all of DCBS's activities. I think there's 10 distinct program divisions. And perhaps not all 10 of those really need to be studied. I don't think Senate Bill 35 was broad enough to study all 35, and I don't know that I would be I think I would be remiss. I don't think I would be fiscally prudent if I came to you today and asked you for the fiscal resources to study all of the divisions that Director Greenfield has under his direction at this time. Again, I think that he's doing an excellent job in administering a program that has a huge impact particularly in rural Oregon. And I think that as we go through the process, he will become more sensitive and to the rural portions of eastern Oregon and rural Oregon, and sensitive to our needs, so that we can get those services delivered in such a fashion that that we may not need a studying of all 10. And I think that's the fiscal impact contemplates that there's going to be a fairly thorough, detailed examination of all 10 of the distinct business programs that are provided by DCBS, and that is that's not necessarily what I would contemplate the mission of the committee to do at all. So it could be substantially less money than the high end that that legislative fiscal has anticipated.
Thank you. Questions? And if no one else going to testify in this bill, I'm inclined to move it to Ways and Means without a recommendation. We'll probably go to your subcommittee, Representative Butler, and let you fix a dollar amount to it that you see appropriate, or possibly do it through a budget note, even if you see that's the way to do it. So with that, we'll close.
I'll just make a comment, maybe. One of the difficulties we have as legislature is trying to prioritize where our dollars need to be spent, which studies need to be done, which aren't, maybe do not need to be done, or at least which ones we ought to put a fire on the priority level. And I, in the last interim, we're struggling with this process, and I know that different bills come through the committees, and everyone has the idea that this is an area that needs to be studied, and that's probably fine. But it does somewhat tie the hands of leadership in order to regard to, we have so much money for our per diem in the interim, and trying to lay out a plan of what we're going to go, and I'm not really necessarily talking against, I think Senator Preston Button knows that, but I'm just saying that is an issue that we start getting into when different committees do exactly this type of presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lundquist, I'm sensitive to that issue, and I guess I had to pick my jaw up off the floor when I saw the potential fiscal impact because I'm sensitive to the fact that we only have so many dollars, and I don't want to exhaust those dollars in any fashion that would be just for another study. I think we tend to study things plenty well enough, and we don't need a great deal more time to study issues as much as we do to go ahead and implement the directives that we've already been given. And so in that regard, certainly the fiscal impact could be weighed based upon what may or may not be really necessary to study as directed by the members of the legislature, and certainly as directed by our co-chairs of Ways and Means. If they feel that some items need to be studied and are willing to allocate a small portion of that, and I think that I could concur with that approach, that if they would study small portions of areas that they deem to be problems, then at that point, I don't think we need to study the whole animal to determine that it is in fact a plant or an animal or a mammal or just what.
Thank you. Any further questions? Close the public hearing, and we'll move to work session on HDR 74. Representative Knope?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move HDR 74 to the floor without recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative moves that the bill be referred to the floor without recommendation and further move to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion on the motion.
So we'll go to the floor first.
It has to go through the floor to get to Ways and Means. It won't be voted on the floor, but it will just. Call the roll.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Knope?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye. Excuse.
Representative Marsat?
Excuse.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Can we see the required number of votes? HDR 74, Million Ways and Means. Session is closed. We will now go to a public hearing on House Bill 3590. We'll open a public hearing. While Representative Seri comes forward, Mr. Putman will give us a brief explanation of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, people who install pumps are now allowed to do electrical work on them if they meet certain criteria, including being in a residence. And this bill would expand that to allow those installers to do the electrical work on groundwater pumps. Your SMS says that there's no fiscal impact statement issued yet, but we now have one that says minimal fiscal impact, so we're not ever really sure what that means other than it doesn't go to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Sinceri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ron Sinceri, State Representative, District 22. I'm not aware of a fiscal impact, but it may be one that's recent. House Bill 3590 is a bill that we put in for people who are the well drillers and who actually work in this field and have up to this time been doing this very work. I came down today to introduce one of our leading well drillers in the Northwest. I'll turn it over to him to be able to share with you the details of what this bill actually accomplished. Ted Pulling.
Thank you. Go ahead. State your name for the record, please.
Chairman, my name is Ted Pulliam. I'm the owner and operator of Ted Pulliam and Olson Well Drilling and Pump Service. I'm also representing of the Oregon Groundwater Association. The purpose of this bill is right now throughout the state, we have an industry of about 200 to 300 contractors and their employees that are supplying the water needs of residential Oregon and agriculture Oregon. And we've been doing this work since the beginning of time, I guess. And the language in the current language basically says what we're doing is in a gray area. It's probably not legal, but everybody looks the other way. Well, it's hard to have a business when everybody looks the other way and you keep trying to expand and do the work. So basically what we're trying to do with the language here is allow us to do legally what we've been doing all along. And that's the whole gist of the entire bill, is to allow us to continue to do what we have been doing without a government agency coming in and saying, no, you can't do that anymore.
Representative Gardner.
Yeah, can you explain a little bit more about the type of work that you're already doing and what size motors are you using, what voltage, that kind of information?
Yes, Representative Gardner. We do what's happening in the real world in the industry. We're doing everything from probably 50 horsepower down to minimum horsepowers of half horse, even a third horse, from 230 volt to single phase, 230 volt, three phase, 460, 480 volt, three phase. That's the type of work we're doing. That's what's happening in the industry. That's not what it says we can do, but that's what's happening. A school runs out of water on Friday morning. There's not one school in the state that calls an electrician. They call a licensed pump installer or a water well drilling contractor that is also a pump installer. And he gets the school up and going. In my research, I found one electrical contractor in the entire state that has a pump truck, and that's in Milton Freewater. And so that's what we're up against. We go do the work, but we're told by the electrical when we take our ongoing education, no, you guys really shouldn't be doing this work, but nobody else wants to do it, so we're going to kind of look away.
Question? But, you know, you're talking about, for one thing, you mentioned a school and maintenance on it, and this says you can install them as well. Do you do installations at 50 horsepower from pumps, 480 volts?
Correct.
Even out in remote locations where you bring, you know, feeders in from great distances, or
Representative Gardner, we go from the panel down the well. We're not bringing the power source in. We're simply installing the wells, the pumps in the wells, and that's what we do. We make the splice on the pump, put it in the hole, bring it up, and in most cases on your heavier powers, we do connect. We have been known to connect the wires to the bottom of the panel and to disconnect the magnetic starter. But in most cases, the electrician does that on the heavier voltage pumps. But on domestic pumps, we're allowed to go to a disconnect, and that's as far as we're allowed to go. According to the electrical board, we cannot do anything when it comes to, like, a school. If they deem that being a commercial operation, we can't do that at all. We'd have to hire an electrician to stand there beside us and watch us install this pump into the well. And I don't know too many electricians that are willing to tighten up 400 or 500 foot of 4 or 6 or 8 inch pipe and spend 8 or 10 hours with 150-pound pipe wrenches. That's the problem we have. And this bill allows us not to do the commercial yet. We're hoping to go to in the next 2 years, getting that part worked out. But this allows us to do the irrigation work for the farm communities and continue doing what we're doing with the residential.
But with what you're doing with the residential, at least in my experience, that's generally just, you know, plugging in the pump and making the pump work. It's not really actually dealing with live parts. What you're talking about in this particular situation is hooking up literally to a disconnect, you know, a high voltage, high horsepower motor, correct?
To a disconnect, yes.
Any questions? The groundwater is not defined in this bill. Mr. Putman has given us a definition of groundwater in the ORS 537.515. Is that correct in your terminology of what you for groundwater?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
Thank you. And so that clearly would not include large irrigation pumps such as in the Columbia River or irrigation canals, places such as this where the water is above ground free flowing.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Ms. Orr, please, you have a question?
Yes. So what you're saying is, thank you, Mr. Chair, you're saying that they could not connect an irrigation pump that was from the surface water in the canal?
That's the way I read the bill.
Representative Lindquist, that's true according to this bill. All I can tell you is what this bill says, not what happens in reality.
But if the irrigation pump was from a well at the mill?
That's the way this bill is drafted.
I haven't figured that one out yet.
It's more restrictive than just general irrigation, a specific groundwater pump on residential and irrigation properties.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. This bill did come about because of a continuing ed conference that we had sponsored by the electrical folks, and this is the first time we became aware of the issue that, in fact, we were doing work that was in violation of statute. This is an effort to make a quick fix of the statute and bring us into compliance. We need to sit down further during the interim and have some fruitful discussions with all the interested parties, including the state electrical inspector and some of the electrical contractors unions, to make sure that we can further define some of these issues and clarify any misunderstandings. We certainly recognize some of the issues that Representative Gardner brought up, that there is severe danger with high voltage, high output motors, and we want to make sure that all parties are comfortable with what we're trying to perform here. The issue why we tried to refine it to the groundwater pumps, of course, we are the groundwater industry doing principally our business is dealing with groundwater. The example that Representative Lundquist brought up of the issue of having a pump that's moving surface water, we haven't addressed that, and that may be something that we want to address during the interim to find out if there is some issues there that we can clarify. But we need to sit down with a broader group of folks and have time to to get some input from them to find out if they're comfortable with proceeding on this issue. And frankly, we just didn't have the time to bring those forces together in the short time period when we became aware that this was an issue. In fact, it was after the bills had been dropped before we became aware that this was an issue, and Representative Sinceri was kind enough to give us a priority bill of his to allow us to at least come forward and bring the issue to you folks. And we do hope to sit down with those folks during the interim and try to craft something that covers the full gamut of some of these issues. For instance, the commercial issue in some of these rural areas. If, in fact, you have a commercial establishment, a restaurant, for instance, in rural America, we need to address those kind of issues, but we haven't addressed it here just because of the word commercial and some of the problems it brings in by just adding that language, because it broadens it out too great. We may have to limit it to size of horsepower or some other reasonings. For instance, I think some of the unions might be very uncomfortable with us expanding to the word commercial, assuming that we were then going to go in and wire things in commercial establishments. That's not our intent. That's always the intent of the electrical folks to do the panel work, to do all the high voltage stuff. We're merely setting pumps, putting up the controls to the pump. The electrical folks are doing the rest of the wiring. But we need time to sit down and go through this in a more thoughtful discussion, and that's why I can't tell you that we've solved the whole issue, but we've solved a major portion of it, at least to give service to those residential and agricultural users that we've historically given service to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Just a further comment. I think as I looked at this, as it was brought to me, it's certainly a legitimate concern, and I think it also presents a dilemma that we have to deal with. If in fact there's only one electrician with a pump truck operating in the state of Oregon, then there's a greater need here. We need to be able to give these men some protection. As I looked at this, and I also asked again today if there have been any accidents as a result of people doing this in the past, none that I've been able to find, nor have I heard of any accidents as a result of this. So as long as we've got an industry that has clearly stated to the committee that what they want to do is to pursue this even beyond this legislation, to be able to work this out so that everyone be doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, we definitely need to create some protection for these people to continue this service, because if we turn that down, we're going to create a problem in our state where there won't be any service available.
One clarification from the industry. You said what has in fact been working out there so far, and what they've been doing on surface water, on irrigation pump. The irrigation companies, are they not hooking that pump up to the panel?
Representative Lindquist, in most cases, what's factually happening is if you've got a 30 horsepower centrifugal pumping out of an irrigation ditch, XYZ pump company will go out, the electrician will install the panel, and he'll hook that pump up to the panel.
Or a pump goes down and put a new pump in.
Correct. Yeah. Or change the impeller or motor.
So we just aren't covering that yet on this.
I think that's what they're saying. President Gardner.
I was just going to ask, what required safety or electrical training at all or for these folks in order for lockout, tagout, or anything to protect the employee that's actually working on?
We have a one-year training. I mean, we have 1 year that we have to be work under a license, limited. I believe the exact language is, what do we call them?
Specialty.
A limited pump installer specialty contractor's license. And it says significant engage in electrical work related to testing, repair, service, maintenance, installation, and replacement. And what a contractor is he has right now, he has to work for, if you're a new employee, if I hire somebody, we had a group that was grandfathered in, and then after that group, you had to work for somebody for a year to be able to get this license. We have, so it's self-trained. I mean, that's as a contractor, I train my employees what to do and what not to do. We have a continuing education with the electrical folks. We just had an 8-hour class with that. And originally, when the bill first came in, there was actually a test, but that didn't survive very long, and that was done away with. And that's the training we have.
But is that required, or is that just what you provide for your employees?
Well, that's required by the rules within that life and specialty.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Joe Brewer and John Gervais.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning.
Go ahead, we'll be ready.
Okay. For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is John Gervais, representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. I have signed up basically as neutral but concerned about the bill. I was involved in the discussions a number of years ago when we created the pump installer's license, along with Craig Teeple from the IBEW. We felt that, as a matter of fact, that those people were doing that work. The greatest concern I have is that there is no requirement for safety or training or anything of any kind for this person. There is a license for the contractor as a person, and the contractor only has to take continuing education, not their employees. And it seems to me that there ought to be some kind of safeguard when you get those big motors that can blow up with power and high voltage and water all mixed together. It gets kind of interesting. And there at least ought to be some kind of training before they go out on their own to do it anyway. Someone that's just tired off the street. There is absolutely no requirement for safety training or anything under this license. So I think as a reality that they're probably correct in that they tend to do most of that, while there's only one electrical contractor that has a pump installing situation, there are a lot of electrical contractors that will go out and do the wiring of the pumps to hook them up. That's not necessarily a problem to get that. I'm sure that there would be those that would argue that it's not necessary to have them also, because on the ground I know that a lot of agricultural people do their own work and have been doing it for generations. And if you get the pump done the right way the first time, a lot of them can be just plug-in type things if you get an electrician to hook them up and wire them up right.
Joe? Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer, Administrator of the Building Codes Division. The division's neutral on the bill as it's presented. Wanted to get on record our definition, or at least what we understand the definition of a groundwater pump to be. That's an electrically operated device that lifts water from an aquifer by means of suction or pressure. This bill will expand the license category into the agricultural property area. They are presently limited to residential work only. And again, the division's neutral on the bill. Be happy to answer any questions you might.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Moving forward. I have no one else signed up to testify on this bill. Is there anyone who would like to testify? If you can't sign up, we'll close the public hearing on this bill. We have floor session in about 4 minutes. According to my schedule, is that correct? Floor session is at 10. Yes. Floor session is at 10. We will put this bill back on the schedule for a later date. We are also scheduled to hold a public hearing and possible work session today on House Bill 2926. We have heard this bill once before. We have amendments that have been drafted, and I think they're in the packet. Anyone that does not have a copy of the amendments in the audience would like to have that available. We will put this bill back in the schedule for either later this week or next week so that everyone who has an interest in the bill has a chance to look at the amendments and comment on them. With that, if there's no further information back to the committee, we will adjourn. Thank you very much.